I want to talk this morning about our life's journey. And in particular, I hope to show the difference between what it means to walk this journey under your own direction and your own power, and what it means to follow Christ. Because following Christ is what makes us Christians. And I was reminded this morning of the need to remember of the joys and the healing that does exist on this journey. But a lot of times, the way that journey plays out, it's hard to see those joys and that healing sometimes. Because in our modern society, we don't like pain. And we often think that it's about our making our own efforts to find a place, to accomplish something, to get somewhere where it's set, comfortable, and safe. Life then is doing whatever it takes to keep things from becoming unsettled, becoming uncomfortable, being displaced. As soon as the kids are out of school, as soon as I get that job, as soon as I retire, then everything will be just right. Then everything will be set. If I have enough insurance or enough savings. It's always about finding the right place and staying there, but we all know that's not really true because we're always on a journey somewhere, whether we like it or not. And sometimes the way ahead doesn't look all that inviting. Sometimes it looks rather dark. Have you ever noticed how much of the Bible is about going somewhere? It's about being on a journey. And it doesn't always seem to be a very easy journey at that. Christian artist Sarah Groves, in her song, Painting Pictures of Egypt, uses the imagery of the Exodus to describe her Christian journey. The Exodus story clearly tells us some things. It tells us that we can't stay where we are and we can't go back. But the way forward can look pretty dark, can look pretty scary. She sings, I don't want to leave here and I don't want to stay. The future seems so hard and I want to go back. How many times did the people with Moses feel like that? Do you ever feel like that? You know you can't go back, and you know you can't stay here, but the future is so uncertain, it's so risky. Frankly, it's so dark looking sometimes. Or maybe your life is filled with worrying about all the possible dangers that could be laying ahead as you desperately try to hold on to life as it is now. Or perhaps you want to go back the way things were. You long to return to the way things were when your life was simpler, when it was easier, when it was better. Like the Israelites, wishing they were back in Egypt instead of wandering through the desert. But God is seeking to lead us, each one of us, on a journey. And it might be through deserts, and it might be through dark valleys. And so therefore, as we go forward, as we stumble forward into whatever the future has to hold for us, it's important that we remember that courage is not the absence of fear, and faith is not the absence of doubt. Let me say that again. Courage is not the absence of fear, and faith is not the absence of doubt. See, God is always calling us somewhere beyond ourselves, out into the darkness, where there may be fear and doubt. In Matthew 16:21, we encounter Jesus and the disciples as they're on the road to Jerusalem in a divine appointment. Jesus' earthly ministry is coming to a close. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed. And on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said, this shall never happen to you. Jesus turned and said to Peter, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. Today is the last Sunday in Lent before Holy Week. Next Sunday, as Jan said, is Palm Sunday. And it remembers Jesus' spectacular arrival in Jerusalem. You may remember the imagery from Sunday school posters or movies or whatever. Crowds singing, praising, throwing palm leaves down so that even the hooves of Jesus' donkey don't have to touch the dirty floor. the dirty street. All these pilgrims from all over Israel and even beyond Israel have come to celebrate their deliverance from slavery, to celebrate Passover, and now they're singing about Jesus, praising him as their king. But in a little while, this same crowd is going to be howling for his blood. See, this is where it was always headed. This is where Jesus' ministry was always going, to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you. But at this point in the story, that week is still ahead. We haven't gotten there yet. Jesus and the disciples are still on the road, but Christ is already telling them what lies ahead, that this is what has to happen. And Peter, at least, doesn't want to hear it. He tells Jesus, this cannot happen. Not to the Messiah, not to God's chosen. That would be unthinkable. Did you know that in Islam, Jesus is considered a prophet sent by God? And so they teach that it's impossible that God would have let Christ die on the cross. At the last minute, God did a switch. Somebody else died in his place. Because the chosen one of God could never suffer such a despicable death. And the fact that Christ was hung on a cross was a major stumbling block to the Jews, because they knew that under the law of Moses, everyone that is hanged on a tree is cursed of God. Deuteronomy 21:23. Impossible that the chosen servant of God, the Messiah, could be condemned under Mosaic law as cursed by God. See, we've heard this story so many times that we miss just how insane it must have sounded to Peter. God has finally sent the Messiah not to save Israel, but just to die? Unthinkable. Never, Lord. Yet Jesus knows it's not unthinkable. In fact, he knows it's inevitable. And so he angrily rebukes Peter. Is Jesus angry with Peter because he doesn't understand? That seems kind of unfair. What Jew in the first century could have possibly understood such a thing? Why didn't Christ just pat Peter on the shoulder, shake his head, as he must have done 100 times, and said something like, "Yeah, Peter, that's the other reason I'm calling you a rock." But he doesn't gently correct Peter. Christ is angry. He calls Peter Satan, the great deceiver. Why? Perhaps because Jesus is afraid. Maybe he even doubts his own resolve to see this thing through. He accuses Peter of being a stumbling block. Why say that unless in Jesus' own mind there was actually a chance that Peter's words might make him stumble on this road to Jerusalem, to the cross? Jesus Christ have a moment of fear and doubt? Impossible. How can God fear? How can God doubt? Remember how the author of Hebrews says that no matter what we are facing, Christ has already faced. And courage is not the absence of fear, and faith is not the absence of doubt. For as we read in Hebrews 2:18, we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who has been tempted in every way, just as we are. Fully God, but also fully man. That is what the church has always proclaimed. One of my oldest and dearest friends is not a Christian. His worldview basically comes from an Americanized Eastern philosophy that draws from Buddhism. A part of that belief is that all suffering is an illusion, and that pain and fear come from being overly attached to this world. Death, therefore, is the ultimate escape from this illusion. Fear and doubt have no place in such a system. They're just attachments to a deceptive view of reality. My friend once suggested that Christ, being a holy man and in touch with the divine, understood this but temporarily forgot it. And this error on Jesus' part led to weeping tears as big as drops of blood in the Garden of Gethsemane just before his arrest. But, my friend said, Jesus recovered himself and went to his death without emotion, in fine Buddhist detachment style. What nonsense. That would make our Lord less than courageous, less than faithful, less than human. When we feel comfortable in our Christianity, when we are lacking in fear or doubt, it might be because we're not taking seriously the words that immediately follow Jesus' rebuke of Peter. When he says, then Jesus says to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. Again, here's a passage so familiar that it's lost all the impact of those original words. Take up your cross and follow me. We've made it meaningless with such phrases as, oh, we all have our cross to bear. As though putting up with an inconvenient neighbor or some other of life's little problems was what Christ had in mind here. How we have so tamed and made inoffensive the cross. But Christ knows where this path is leading. It's leading not only to his death, but his disgrace and abandonment. Judas will betray him. Peter will desert him. The others will scatter like the frightened sheep they are. And even God will leave Christ crying, my God, why have you abandoned me? The road that Jesus had to walk into Jerusalem wasn't maybe actually through a valley, but the holy city did sit on high ground. Jerusalem was strategically important because it commanded the views of all the approaches. And Golgotha, the place of the skull, the site of public executions, sat outside the city and was believed to overlook the city. After all, the Romans wanted everybody to see what they did to people who they thought threatened peace. So it's not a stretch to imagine that the shadow of Golgotha actually lay across the road into Jerusalem. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, literally and figuratively, Jesus was approaching Jerusalem by the way of the valley of the shadow of his own death. So is it any wonder that Peter is trying to convince Jesus that this is not the road we're supposed to be on might have been a temptation to Jesus? Because he could see the darkness looming ahead. Condemned, disgraced, abandoned. And Jesus says, if you want to be one of mine, this is the road we're on. Can we really take Christ's word seriously and not face some fears and doubts of our own? But what happened to victorious Christianity, the message that all you have to do is profess Jesus as Lord and all your problems will be solved? Your life will be blessed and full of good things. Just come to our church. Nothing bad will ever happen. Doesn't that sell more memberships? Tell that one to James, Peter, Thomas, and the other apostles who died, murdered, following Christ. In fact, it seems only one of the disciples actually managed to make it to old age and die. And John, he gets shipped off to Patmos to live on a wilderness island. Good times. But martyrdom aside, this isn't how this life works out most of the time, is it anyway? So what a terrible thing we do to people when we tell them that this Christian journey is about being on Easy Street. Ever know someone who's been taught that Christianity is all about victory, and then when tragedy struck, they walked away from God? I have. Bad things happening to good people is one of the major stumbling blocks to the faith. And it doesn't help if we keep telling people in so many ways that if you're a Christian, then God's like Santa Claus and nothing bad will happen to you. And that if you're struggling with depression, fear and doubt, or if bad things keep happening to you, it's because of sin in your life, and so you must not be a very good Christian. See, the truth is, life happens to the Christian and to the non-Christian. And there's no promise that you will not walk through dark valleys. In fact, the reality is that one day you will walk in the valley of the shadow of death. So here's the choice and the challenge and yes, the promise. You can go through life using all your energy, resources, and time in hopeless attempts to hang on to the life you're trying to craft for yourself, or you can give that all up and surrender your all to this journey with Christ. See, the radical message of the cross is that in surrendering your life to the will of God in the very same way and traveling the same journey of surrender that Christ traveled, you will, like him, gain the life that God has always promised, which is why Christ tells the disciples in Matthew 16, whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will gain it. Christ walks the dark valley and invites us with him on this journey. Not without fear, not without doubt, but with the simple assurance that our God is a God who keeps his promises. And one more thing. We have Christ who has already gone before us on this journey. And he walks with each one of us even now as we struggle through our own dark valleys. Have courage and have faith. For no matter how dark the way, if Christ is truly Lord of your life, if it's his steps you're following, then you are on the right path. You're on the best of journeys. And you're never alone. We've been doing a lot of symbolic things for Lent this season. And we've been asking you sometimes to come up and leave things at the cross. But today, I'm going to invite you to come up and pick up a cross. These are just popsicle sticks. They're not very well made particularly. Hardly worth getting up for out of your seat just to come get this. Won't go on your wall and make a very nice decoration. But as a symbol of your desire to be dragged into this, and I mean drug, because if you've been there, you know what it feels like, into this journey with Christ. As a symbol of your commitment to give up, you're trying to hang on to your own life and pick up this cross with the significance of those first words, then I prayerfully invite you as the worship team comes up and as we lift our voices in worshiping the Lord, as the songs move you, as you feel committed, then I invite you to come up and pick up one of these. But only if you're willing to be made willing to walk this journey with Christ. Amen.